This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
Welcome to Hey YA, a Book Riot podcast covering young adult literature, from great new books to favorite classic reads, from new stories to the latest in on-screen adaptations. Hey YA is here to elevate the exciting world of young adult lit. I'm your host, Erica Ezzafetti, and I'm joined today by Book Riot editor Danica Ellis. Danica, how are you?
Hello, I'm doing well. How about you?
I'm doing very well because I realize I don't think we've ever recorded together before, have we?
I don't think we have. That's true.
After all this time, yeah. All that work, what did it get me?
I'm on TikTok
a lot.
Yeah, it's stuck in my head too.
Yes. Finally,
I don't even know where it's from.
It feels very Disney-ish.
I thought it was just a musical.
Musical, yes. Probably random musical. So yes, we are recording on March 8th. We are going to be talking about some of our favorite queer YA books. Danica is the writer of Our Queerest Shelves, which is our LGBTQ+ newsletter. Definitely check that out when you get a chance. So also Danica got a little, their own website. Mm-hmm. It's a tongue twister, so you'll have to say it. It's hard for me to. That's a big word for Elmo.
It's the Lesbury, like lesbian library, but it's all sapphic books. And I started it in 2010, I think.
What? So
it's been a while.
I'm amazed that you were like organized enough. In 2010?
Yeah.
What's
weird
is
that's before Book Riot started. So the Lesbury is older than Book Riot, just by a tiny little bit, but it amuses me.
Just by a hair. That is amusing. I did not know that trivia, that lore. I appreciate mm-hmm. that. Mm-hmm. Yes. So getting into today's show, before we get to the books, we do have some news. First off, we have Twilight. There's a Twilight animated series that's being shot by Lionsgate. Now, I know with adaptations, like this type of development, sometimes like between this type of development and actually seeing the show, there can be like a lot of time. And then sometimes it moves quickly. I think it depends on the franchise, on the, you know, Twilight is very popular. But I was a little surprised when I saw animated series. Did you ever get into Twilight?
I did not get into Twilight. I read the first book in high school, but I didn't continue it. Not a big fan for various issues.
Yes.
But yeah, I wonder about the animated series because I feel like animation, I would have thought this would have happened a while ago, I guess. Like it doesn't seem like animated adaptations are a big thing right now. It feels like that was something that was tried years ago and then they dropped it because animating is expensive.
Yes.
So I'm also just picturing, have you seen the Twilight manga adaptation?
I have not. Should I Google that?
That is what I'm picturing the whole, which I'm sure is not what the animated series would be, but it's just the manga adaptation is the illustration style is very of its time, I think. Very angsty expressions and everything. And it amuses me to think of the whole show looking like that.
That would be really funny. I'm looking at some pictures. Yeah, this is the one that's on Amazon. Mm-hmm. It kind of reminds me of like shoujo a little bit, like from like the 90s though.
Yeah, exactly. That's it feels very dated. I feel like even when it first came out, it seemed pretty
it was already dated. But. Yeah. Wow. I never knew.
Yes. I was working at a bookstore during that time. So
yeah. Oh, were these Twilight graphic novels flying off the shelves at that time?
Not really. It was just the Twilight craze in general. There was a lot of hype.
Yeah, this has 56,000 ratings on Goodreads. Okay.
Wow.
Yeah. Yeah, I never got into Twilight either. I feel like if I had read it when it first came out, which is like when I was in high school, I would have liked it. Mm. I don't know if I would still like it now because of some of the issues with it, as you mentioned.
Yeah.
But I feel like I would have liked it if I first read it, honestly. Because I had some issues, too. Like, it had issues. I had issues at the time. So we would have matched. It would have been an issued problematic pairing between the two of us. So, but yeah, I did not get into this at that time. Animated series, like you said, is interesting. So, yeah. Curious to see how that develops. Mm-hmm. So we have a couple other little news developments to discuss, but first we're going to hear from our first sponsor. Today's episode is brought to you by Bloom Books. Diana Dixon has a busy summer and no time for tall, gorgeous hockey player Shane's shenanigans. Because you know what? If they shenan once, they'll shenan again. So she thinks she knows exactly who he is when he moves into her apartment building. But turns out Shane's sick of hookups and tired of being on the rebound after his long-term girlfriend called it quits. But when his ex comes back into the picture, he needs a plan. And who better to play his new girlfriend than his sassy new neighbor? So a fake relationship might be perfect for Diana's own ex issues, but Diana is used to living by the rules. Will she learn that when it comes to love, rules are meant to be broken? Make sure to check out The Dixon Rule by Elle Kennedy. Elle Kennedy is a New York Times and USA Today bestselling author with over 1 million copies of her books sold. So this is going to be another banger, y'all. Make sure to check it out. And thanks again to Bloom Books for sponsoring this episode. Today's episode is brought to you by Gallery Books. So Anna Green thought she was marrying Liam West for access to subsidized family housing while at UCLA, which is an interesting reason to marry someone, but you know, in this economy. So anyway, she signed divorce papers when the graduation caps were tossed and she thought she was done. She wasn't. 3 years later, Anna is a starving artist living paycheck to paycheck while West is a Stanford professor. Now, he is part of a conglomerate. His family owns this mega grocery store chain. He's not interested in working for them, but he is interested in those greenbacks, honey, that come in the form of a $100 million inheritance. To get it, he has to be married for 5 years. That's where our girl Anna comes back into play. So the two will fake a marriage, but as he gets to know her and gets to appreciate the feisty, foul-mouthed, paint-splattered girl that she is, he'll begin to wonder if the money is worth the love of his life. Pick up The Paradise Problem by Christina Lauren to find out if it is. And thanks again to Gallery Books for sponsoring this episode. Okay, now this next one, like, I lived in New York City for like undergrad or whatever. Mm-hmm. And I say that because I would see celebrities here and there, like randomly. And the thing with being like becoming a New Yorker, living in New York City, is like you're not supposed to freak out when you see celebrities, because it's like it's like passe. It's like I'm in New York, I don't care. Like, that's every day. Right. Everyday thing. Not literally everyday thing, it kind of is. I'm saying all that to get to, if I saw LeVar Burton, I might act a fool.
I think that's fair.
Right? I might.
There's got to be exceptions.
There's exceptions to every rule. So even if I was in New York City still living to this day, I'd be like, that's LeVar Burton. Oh my God. Mm-hmm. So there is a Reading Rainbow documentary trailer that dropped. And it is titled Butterfly in the Sky, because obviously it is. that song is like nestled deep into my subconscious. Mm-hmm. It's a part of me. I'm excited for this. It has like kind of a funky release. Like it's going to be in select AMC theaters on March 17th. And then later it's going to be streamed like in April, I think. Mm-hmm. But yeah. Well, I was going to say, you live in Canada and are from Canada. Mm-hmm. Did y'all have... I know we had this on PBS, which is like our public, like free channel. Mm-hmm. Like, did y'all have?
We had Reading Rainbow for sure. I don't. Yeah, it's there's some things that are different. We get a lot of the same stuff. Like that the Canadian sense. Sesame Street is Sesame Park.
What? But... What? 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 Sesame Park? Is it mm-hmm. the? Is it just the name change or is it like it's different? The
setting change, I think. I can't really remember. I've watched a lot of Sesame Park lately.
Oh my gosh. This is
yeah, it's different all over the world. It's like tailored to whatever issues are happening there.
That makes
apparently,
sense.
Apparently, in Canada, we don't have streets. We just have parks.
You just have parks.
You just have a wonderland of wilderness. But anyway, I am excited.
That's amazing.
About the documentary. And I was thinking mm-hmm. while I was watching the trailer, I was thinking how mm-hmm. In Sesame Street or Park or whatever and Reading Rainbow, they mm-hmm. had like actual just like regular kids talking about yeah. things. And I yeah. feel like we don't do that anymore, which is fair enough because like those poor vlogger children, you know, we probably don't need anymore.
But, yeah,
Jesus. But it's cute watching the trailer and just having these like yeah. adorable tiny kids who are not actors. Like they just want to talk about this book and it's adorable.
It is very cute. Yeah, I feel like it would be the mommy vloggers and other parental vloggers. I feel like it would be a different thing today, but back then it was like more possible without mm-hmm. without all the exploitation. But that the trailer is super cute and it tickles it scratches this like nostalgia itch I have.
Yeah,
and I'm
definitely.
Really excited to see it. Yeah. In sad news, the creator of Dragon Ball and Dragon Ball Z, Chrono Trigger, and other manga, Akira Toriyama has passed away. I believe he passed away last night. I don't know. I haven't discussed manga a lot with you. Mm. I don't know. Did you ever get into Dragon Ball or Dragon Ball Z?
I did not. I do read manga, but it tends to be more of the realistic stuff. I haven't gotten into kind of the One Piece and Dragon Ball, and I almost got into Naruto when I was a kid, but I didn't quite latch on. What about you?
Oh my god, my family, we actually all watched Dragon Ball and Dragon
Ball. Oh really?
Yes, we would go get the VHSs from Blockbuster.
Amazing.
Isn't that like my mother, my stepdad, my younger siblings, we will all be like tuned in. And let me tell you how they stretched those episodes, honey. It was a lot of filler. It was a lot of doggone filler in those tapes.
Yeah.
Okay. I felt cheated, but I also was like, oh my God, what happens next? I am super into my little like Naruto came a little later, but my little brother likes Naruto, and I am very much into the shonen anime. I'm starting to branch out of that and get into some like slice of life and different things.
Right.
But I am definitely a shonen girl, so Akira Toriyama.
I was really into Sailor Moon, I should say. I was
of course.
Because
that makes
who
sense.
Who wasn't?
Who wasn't? I haven't seen Sailor Moon in so long, but I remember watching it when I was literally like 4 years old or something, and like late at night kind of thing. I was always a night owl. I told you I had issues. I told you that's why Twilight and I would match. I told you I was a problematic child. Would never go to sleep. But yes, this is sad. And Akira Toriyama passed away at 68, which I think is amazing because it's like he did all that so young. Like Dragon Ball is like hella old.
Yeah.
That's amazing.
Yeah, it said that he had 45 years in the industry.
That's so wild. Yeah. And to be so influential, like Dragon Ball, Dragon Ball Z, like, ooh, so iconic. But yes, at least he, you know, he was here for a time. He graced us with his presence. We appreciate that. We'll link to that article in the show notes also. And just so you know, we have a book club newsletter. It's called In the Club. In the Club will deliver recommendations for the best books to discuss in your book clubs, from buzzy new releases to brilliant throwbacks. The books highlighted in this newsletter will drive your book club discussions. We'll also share some book club friendly recipes and interesting bookish updates from all over. You can become a paid subscriber. You can get even more recommendations plus community features. In other words, the newsletter will keep you well met, well read, and well fed. You can visit bookriot.com/in the club to sign up. That's bookriot.com/in the club. And guess what, y'all? Your girl writes the newsletter. Hi. Like, I write it. Like, obviously you want to hear more from me, so like sign up for it. Like, there is a free portion, has plenty of stuff, but just the paid subscription gets you like a little extra more, a little extra treat as a treat. So make sure to check that out. Now, today, Danica, you are the one to go to for queer books. So I was like, let's talk about some queer YA books, like the faves. I honestly feel like I should read and should have read, even up until this point, more queer YA. In my defense, before I started working for Book Riot and therefore hosting this podcast, co-hosting it rather, I feel like I wasn't reading a lot of diverse YA. I was reading more diverse other books. But like, as far as queer books or even YA books by people of color, I feel like I wasn't reading a lot of them. And so I feel like with co-hosting this podcast, I've read a lot more. And it's interesting because I feel like I was just reading more adult books, but I would read YA books occasionally. But when I would read YA books, I would read the ones that were kind of promoted more. And interestingly enough, because I wasn't outright looking for YA, although I liked it. I was more, like I said, I was reading more diverse adult books. And what I noticed was I realized there's a direct correlation between reading diverse books for me. When I say diverse, again, I mean queer books, books by people of color, different things like that. There's a direct correlation between me reading more diverse books and finishing the books that I'm reading. Interestingly enough, because before I would read the books that were pushed, and I'm like, okay, sometimes they'd be cute. And sometimes I'd be like, you know what? I've been trying to finish this book forever. What is wrong with me? Like, because I wasn't like super deep, like super duper deep into book world. Like, you know, I wasn't writing for a book site. And I was just pleasure reading. So I feel like I was going to ask you if you had that same experience, but you've been writing for the Lesbrary since forever. So I don't think that applies to you.
Yeah, it's interesting because I think YA has been kind of leading the diversity charge. Like, the YA has been more diverse than most genres of adult books for quite a while. So I almost had the opposite, where I was reading a lot of diverse YA and then not finding it as much with adult books, which is like something that's not really true anymore. But especially in my like early 20s, I was reading a lot more YA because at the time that was like where the queer books were. Like, you could have romance, which was by very small indie publishers, or you could, you know, have YA that was from the bigger publishers and easier to get. So, yeah, that I find that funny. It's and both in terms of like queer books, but also authors of color. I feel like there's been way more of a push for diverse authors in YA, which is like good and bad because it's also like you hear about authors being told like that's more of a YA thing, and you're like, being black, that's a YA thing. Like,
are you serious? I haven't seen that.
I've heard authors talk about it. That they're like, you know, it's a selling point in YA to have diversity, but not in adult books.
We just here's the thing. I'm black, so I can tell this our secrets. We actually disappear after the age of like 21 or so. So I am an enigma. I shouldn't exist. So there you go.
And that works out.
Yeah, it works out. Works out.
It's fine.
It's totally okay. Yes. Yeah, I think for me it probably was because I wasn't reading a lot of YA in the first place. And I was just like, but yeah, it is interesting how publishers get stuck on things that That sums it up. I was like, how do I say this concisely without rambling? And you were like, yeah. And I was like, yeah, how you said it, I was like, that is a perfectly what I was going to say. I don't have to even say anything. Yeah, that's perfect. It's perfectly communicated. So yes, what's the first book, your favorite, one of your favorite queer YA books you're gonna talk about?
I immediately regretted this topic because it's so broad and I could just talk forever. I've got like a whole list at the library of my favorites where I have like dozens of YA ones alone. So this feels completely arbitrary.
Fair. Very fair.
Especially because I tried to pick I tried to make sure this wasn't all sapphic books because that's what I read the most, especially for the lesbary. But obviously that's not all of queer YA. So disclaimer, disclaimer, disclaimer. One of my favorites is The Miseducation of Cameron Post by Emily M. Danforth. And this was it just blew my mind when I read it because I read it in 2012 and it was still kind of early days for queer YA and for me paying attention to queer books. And it was kind of an anomaly for how much it was getting pushed by mainstream sources, that it was like an actual one of the big five publishing companies and it was getting reviewed in all of the journals and things. And that was very, very exciting. So I picked it up and just absolutely fell in love with it. It's a huge book. It's like 500 pages, which for YA, I feel like is long. And it's a coming of age story. And it starts with Cameron Post. Basically, it starts with her having her first kiss with a girl. And then when she goes home, she finds out that her parents have died in just a completely freak accident. And she grew up in this pretty conservative area. She gets taken in by her very religious aunt. And this is in a small town of Montana in the early 90s. And those kind of two things of her parents dying and her queerness get kind of linked in her mind. So it's not the happiest book necessarily, but I just love Emily M. Danforth's writing because she manages to pull off these quirky main characters that still feel believable, which I think is a tricky thing with teens in movies or books, being as weird as teens really are, but not so much that they feel like a made up character. I do have to give a warning for at some point Cameron is sent to this Pray Away the Gay camp, which is horrific, but she finds some friends there and I can't really give any spoilers after that, but it is just so beautifully written and uplifting. And then I got to the end of that almost 500 pages and just wanted there to be hundreds more. So that was kind of my my first favorite Queer YA book, I would say. And it holds up. It's beautiful.
Oh.
Yeah, The Miseducation of Cameron Post. What about you? What's
your first? That sounds amazing. 500 pages is pushing my ADHD. But, you know, audiobooks help with that.
That's true. When the
focus isn't focusing. I want to say, too, I think it's interesting how you talk about quirky characters and making them feel real and lived in, especially for teenage characters. It's interesting because... Yeah, I would agree with what you said, like, because I feel like real teenagers are trying on identities. Mm-hmm. And sometimes in real life instances, teenagers are like being stereotypical in those identities. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So it's just an interesting thing to think about because it's like we don't really know who we are at that age. Mm-hmm. So we're trying on these things and we're trying them in a certain way. We're trying them as we think they are, even if that's not really what being a human means. So it's interesting that you said that. But for my first book, I have to apologize because we spoke about this the last main episode. Vanessa mentioned it. But it is one of my favorite queer YA books. So I'm like, I had to talk about it, and that is The Taking of Jake Livingston by Ryan Douglas. I'll be brief with the description because y'all got it already. Basically, it follows Jake Livingston. He is a gay Black teen living in Atlanta, Georgia, and he's like one of the only Black kids at his prep school. And that comes with a host of microaggressions and all this stuff. And it's weird too, because his brother is like, his older brother is super popular and he's not. So there's some weird stuff with that. And so he's having a hard time fitting in, especially because he can see dead people or dead ghouls, let's call them. So they're kind of like ghosts. And they play out their like last moments. So he'll just kind of see them around and he kind of has to deal with that without seeming off to other people who can't see them. So there is this kid, Sawyer, who, okay, trigger warning, content warning for death and abuse, homophobia, all the things kind of. So, there's this kid, Sawyer, who was troubled when he was alive. He basically shot up the school. And so Jake starts to have these interactions with Sawyer, which are not really typical for his interactions with ghosts/ghouls. Because the thing is, usually ghouls are like chill. They're like, he sees them and they're just doing what, you know, a little thing, what they're doing before they died, whatever led to their death. And he's just like, all right, they over there doing that, minding their business. Sawyer is like in frisky. Sawyer wants to possess Jake because something that happened to him, he's still like angry. He's full of all this rage and it like manifests into making him more powerful. So Jake deals with that. They get into what happened to Sawyer, what's happening currently to Jake, and there's this really powerful moment. I mentioned it when I was speaking to Vanessa as she was describing this. There's like a kind of like Avatar, like ancestor moment. You watched Avatar,
Dan? Mm-hmm. Of course.
Right. Like any person would, especially from our generation. It's a masterpiece in animation is Avatar. Like, you know when Aang would talk to the previous avatars and they would like all line up?
Right.
It was kind of a moment like that. It was very like, ooh, like my hairs are raised on my arms. Like I got little goosebumps. Anyway, so I won't speak too much more on that because we spoke about it before, but I really like this story. It like I said, it gave me goosebumps. So again, that is The Taking of Jake Livingston by Ryan Douglas. And I'm excited to hear your next pick. Before we do get into that, let's hear again from our sponsor. Today's episode is brought to you by Disney Books. Do y'all like Caribbean mythology? What's more, a thriller inspired by Caribbean mythology? If you do, I got something for you. A must-read thriller that draws from the darkest corners of Caribbean mythology from acclaimed author Sarah Das, who crafts a chilling tale of magic, murder, and how far we'll go to protect what's ours. It's perfect for fans of Angeline Bouley and Tiffany D. Jackson. So, unlike other people on the small island of St. Virgil, Selena Da Silva does not believe in magic. She has a logical mind. She likes botany. She wants to study pharmacology. But then her mother gets sick and she's tethered to the island and she has to make money. So what does she do? She cons a couple gullible tourists with these useless talismans and phony protection rituals. But then one of the tourists ends up dead and at the center of a strange string of murders. And the truth Selena has been denying can no longer be avoided. There is evil lurking in the forest that surrounds St. Virgil. And to find out what that evil is, make sure to pick up It Waits in the Forest by Sarah Das. And thanks again to Disney Books for sponsoring this episode. Today's episode is brought to you by Flatiron Books, publisher of 888 Love and the Divine Burden of Numbers by Abraham Chang. So this is an interesting love story. It's great for fans of Tomorrow and Tomorrow and Tomorrow and High Fidelity. It's set in the mid-90s at NYU. And it follows young Wang, who has gotten the advice of love through Chinese numerology from his uncle. So he believes that he will have seven great loves in his life. And then he meets Irena in 95. And she's like the best. She's brilliant, charismatic, quick-witted, funny. They fall in love. But the thing is, she's number six. So if he is to have seven great loves, does that mean his time with Irena is going to come to an end? So this is a love letter to Western pop culture, Eastern traditions, and being a first-generation New Yorker. Make sure to check it out. And thanks again to Flatiron Books, publisher of 888 Love and the Divine Burden of Numbers by Abraham Chang for sponsoring this episode. Okay, Danica, like, so the next book you have on your list, mm-hmm. I started it and I didn't finish it, but it's not the book's fault.
Okay.
I want to, this is a reminder to finish it.
Yeah. So this is another horror one. It's The Spirit Bears Its Teeth by Andrew Joseph White. And I've always said I'm not really a horror person, but I've just found quite a few favorite horror books now, and I think I'm a I think I'm a reluctant horror fan. I don't mean to be, but sometimes they're really good, and this
we
is
won't
one
hold
of
it
them.
Against you, Danica. It's okay. Live your truth, Danica. You like horror? It's okay. Oh.
And what's funny is that this was it was not a light horror read either. It's one of the most nauseating books I've read, but I mean that as a compliment.
Yes.
I should probably just say what it is generally about. It's a YA horror novel set in a fantasy London in 1883. And a few generations ago, people began being born with purple eyes. And if you have purple eyes, it means you can communicate with the spirit world. And Silas has purple eyes. He is an autistic trans teenage boy. And he basically has his parents trying to marry him off to be the perfect wife, because a lot of people want wives with purple eyes, because what they really want are sons with purple eyes, because this is Victorian London and women and assigned female at birth people don't have a lot of power. So that is what's ahead of him, and that is not what he wants at all, because Silas, his special interest is being a surgeon, and he has spent every waking moment trying to learn about surgery, really wants to become a surgeon. Obviously, there are a lot of things that are against him in that. And he has this big gamble where he is trying to get the chance to study officially, and that gamble doesn't work out for him, and he is sent to Braxton's finishing school and sanatorium. So Victorian sanatorium, pretty terrible for anybody, not a great place to be in general, but when you're also trans and autistic, that makes it a lot harder. So there's a lot of ableism, misogyny, transphobia, and that would be enough. And that is a lot of the horror, is just that very realistic element. But then a ghost girl reaches out to Silas and asks for help. And he finds out that something even worse is happening at Braxton, and girls are dying, and he has to figure out what's happening and how to stop it, or it's probably going to come for him too. So the reason this is one of the most nauseating books I've read is that Silas really sees everything through this medical lens. So even when nothing gory is happening, the way he describes things is often kind of gory. The metaphors that he uses, the things that he notices. He has a really distinct voice, which is why I was so surprised that the audiobook is really good, because I thought it would be a really difficult thing to try to narrate, because the main character just has this really distinct way of thinking and speaking, but the narrator does an amazing job with it. So I recommend both the audio and print versions. Ooh. It's brutal, it's bloody, and a lot of that is real life. It is a lot of those that ableism, transphobia, misogyny. He goes through constant misgendering. So it's not an easy read. There's a lot of gore. There's some descriptions of medical procedures, including an on-page cesarean section.
Oh.
Very bloody. I also want to give a content warning for sexual assault, but the writing is so evocative, the voice is so distinct, and the plot really pulls you along. So even though this is not something I would have thought that I would like, I ended up just being completely pulled into the story. There's also some passages from, you're not sure who the character is, but they're dead from the beginning of the book, and they're narrating parts of it. So that's kind of a little mystery element. So I really loved that one. Now I'm going to have to read Andrew Joseph White's other books, because he has one before that's already out. And then I think at least one, possibly two, coming out soon. Mm-hmm. And that's The Spirit Bears Its Teeth by Andrew Joseph White.
I feel like, honestly, as far as horror, body horror, any kind of horror, I feel like women and people assigned female at birth have so much material.
Right?
I'm just so like, true. Cesarean sections. Okay, oh. I'm like, where do I start? Okay, I saw this like demonstration. There was a gynecologist or a nurse, I forget, she was on TikTok, and she was demonstrating using, you know what I'm talking about?
I saw that with the like fabric layers and all the things I cut through. Oh my God.
Yes. And she put you know exactly, you know the terror. When you said cesarean section, I had a visceral, I was like, oh, I went back and I'm like, how am I having a visceral reaction? So basically this lady had a binder full of these like different colored fabrics and like construction papers that she had put into these like clear sheets so you could see through them, and she would turn each one, and basically they each represented a layer of tissue, flesh that would have to be like peeled back, cut open, etc., in a cesarean section to get to the baby. And I was like, okay, this is a lot for me. And then she got to the muscles. You can't cut through muscles. So you pry them apart. I'm like, no one will be prying apart my muscles. That's one thing I know.
That's one thing I know. That's what I know for sure. Is that no one is going to be split opening my muscles like curtains.
Mm-mm.
No.
Thank you.
And I was like, the things we go through, all that work, and what did it get us? Why did we do it? So then you want to talk about sanatoriums, insane asylums, which were real things that women were sent to when they were queer, when they didn't want to get married, even when they were just like seen as a bother. Like this was real life. And I'm like, you don't even have to, it's like, you don't even have to make anything up. We have so much source material for horror.
Yeah.
Like, even now, you don't have to go again, Caesarean section. That is a body horror 101 for me.
It's true.
So I'm just like, oh God, it's just so much. So I just wanted to share I had a visceral reaction while you were speaking. Yeah. So fun times. So yes. So the next book I have is also about a trans boy. It's called Boys Run the Riot by Kaito Gaku. And this is when I said a few minutes ago about trying to read more manga that's not just like action shonen, this definitely falls under that. It's more realistic. There are no sci-fi or fantasy elements. I mean, I still like it though, despite that. it's still good. So it's about Ryo, who is in high school and has known for a while that he's really a boy inside, but can't tell anyone. And early on, we learn that he has a crush on his friend that he's had for a minute. Can't tell her that either. Darn it. So it's just Rio's going through a lot. And it's like, he's just like uncomfortable in his skin, uncomfortable in his surroundings. But one way that he likes to express himself is through clothing. Like, he loves wearing boys and men's clothing. He's super fashionable. It's just clothing and fashion is a way Ryo likes to style himself. Thing is, when he goes to school, I don't know if you're familiar with Japanese schools, but because it takes place in Japan, again, manga, Japanese schools, you have to wear a uniform. And since, again, Ryo has not shared that he's a boy, the uniforms are gendered. So Ryo, like, really does not like to wear the skirt that he's supposed to because of his assigned gender. So that's an issue. So then things start to turn around, though, when older student Jin gets introduced to the class. And Ryo, so here's where it's like, okay, Ryo, you a little messy. You a little judgmental. Okay. Ryo immediately is like, oh, he's here. Like, he's older. Probably means he got held back. And Jin is just like this, like, chill dude. He looks like, he does look like he would be the one to, like, curse in the back of the school bus. Remember those kids? Or, like, smoke in the bathroom. He does look like that a little bit. But, like, so that's it. That's his choice. He does look like that, though. So, and Ryo's like, oh, look at this guy. So he kind of looks like that and he kind of sticks out in a way, but he's also like very comfortable with himself. So then, okay, boom. Ryo's like, this guy's bad news. But then they run into each other at a pop-up shop. It's like this like indie, fashion brand that has buzz. Like, if you're super into fashion, like street fashion, you know about this brand. So they both run into each other at a pop-up shop. They both reach for the same shirt and they look up. They're like, oh, you're you. Oh, that's you. It's you. And they're like, oh, so we kind of have similar fashion. And Ryo is like, not really into that. He's like, oh, I have to run into him. Again, judgmental. Okay. Mm-hmm. And so, but then Jin is like, chill. He down for whatever. And he approaches Ryo. He's like, let's start a fashion brand, because obviously that's the next, that's where your mind goes. I ran into this person at a pop-up store. Let's start a fashion brand.
Obviously. Clearly.
Obviously. And so Ryo is obviously, again, judgmental. And he's like, no thanks. But Ryo's still struggling with stuff. His classmates say he should act more ladylike, excuse me, think that he's weird. So there's like some trans, I say a transphobia. They don't know that he's trans because he hasn't shared it, but it's still like very uncomfortable. Mm-hmm. And I, because I don't know fully, like, where, I don't know where transness and queerness are, like, what stage they are at acceptance and knowledge wise. They are in Japan at the moment, so I don't know what's going on with that. But it is very uncomfortable, and it just makes, I feel like, I'm like, if this were, if I were real, I would feel like, what safe space do I have? Like, you have to go to school. You're there for so many hours a day. And it's like, you have to be uncomfortable and feel these uncomfortable comments. It's like, you know. So Ryo, again, judgmental. He treats Jin kind of poorly. But Jin is chill. Jin is a road dog. Like, Jin is down for whatever, I'm trying to tell you. So... So Ryo confesses that he's a boy to Jin, and Jin's like, all right, that's what's up. So like, that's what I'll say. Like, Jin is down for whatever, and very understanding and accepting. And so then Ryo is like, okay, I can be myself with this person. He's chill. And so they're like, let's start a fashion brand. Ryo is convinced, and Ryo starts to gradually be himself more and more, and it also focuses on them starting this fashion brand. And so so it's really cool. I really like the art style. It's manga, so it's in black and white apart from the cover, but I feel like, all right, this is my little 2 cents. I feel like, as someone who watches, I'm not like super up there in terms of how much anime I watch, because there are some people who like watch it, but I watch it more than the average American, I would say. Sometimes I feel like the art styles are very similar, and I'll say that applies to anime and manga. I like that this art style is a little different, and it's also aesthetically pleasing, so I like the art style. And yeah, so that is Boys Run the Riot by Kaito Gaku. And I am excited to hear your next one, but we're going to hear from our sponsor real quick first. Today's episode is brought to you by Bloom Books. Charming, easygoing, and rich, Xavier Castillo has the world at his fingertips. He also has no interest in taking over his family's empire, but that hasn't stopped women from throwing themselves at him. Unless, of course, the woman in question is his publicist. The cool, the intelligent, the ambitious Sloane Kensington, who is a high-powered publicist who's used to dealing with difficult clients, but none infuriate or tempt her more than a certain billionaire heir with his stupid dimples and laid-back attitude. She may be forced to work with him, but she'll never fall for him because he's a client and that's all he'll ever be, right? Right, girl, like we all know. So just in case you didn't know, author Anna Wong is the best-selling author and book talk viral author of the Twisted Love series, the King of Sin series. Miss Wong got it going on, okay? Make sure to check out King of Sloth by Anna Wong. And thanks again to Bloom Books for sponsoring this episode. Today's episode is brought to you by Flatiron Books, publisher of The Familiar by Leigh Bardugo. This is one I'm actually super excited about. I liked Leigh Bardugo's other adult fantasy books, and so I'm really looking forward to this one. It's set in the Spanish Golden Age during a time of high-stakes political intrigue and glittering wealth. It follows Luzia, a servant in the household of an impoverished Spanish nobleman who reveals a talent for little miracles. Her social climbing mistress demands Luzia use her gifts to win over Madrid's most powerful players, but what begins as simple amusement takes a dangerous turn. Luzia will need to use every bit of her wit and will to survive, even the help of Guillen Santangel, an immortal familiar whose own secrets could prove deadly for them both. So The Familiar by Leigh Bardugo is on sale now. And like I said, it's a must read of the season. It's perfect for anyone who loves history, a little bit of magic, a lot of danger. You can get your copy now at LeighBardugoTheFamiliar.com. And thanks again to Flatiron Books, publisher of The Familiar by Leigh Bardugo, for sponsoring this episode. Okay, Danica, what is your next book?
Yeah, my next pick is one I am a little embarrassed took me so long to get to because it's amazing and everyone has been saying that for so long. Mm-hmm. But I finally read it last month and it's Last Night at the Telegraph Club by Melinda Lowe. And it's as good as everyone says. It earns all the awards that it got. Everyone was right. I don't know why it took me so long.
I am surprised it took you that long for that one. For the lesbian?
I know. And Danica. I've read like Melinda Lowe's other books. I love her books. I don't know.
Wow.
You know, sometimes it happens. It's owned.
I know. I'm teasing you. There are so many books. So many.
There's so many books.
Yes.
But this is, if you missed it, this is a story of a Chinese American lesbian teenager growing up in the 50s in San Francisco. And then she sees an ad for a male impersonator who is performing at the Telegraph Club, which kind of blows her mind and kind of opens up a whole world she didn't know was there. And then she is washing her hands in the school bathroom and she had clipped the ad out of the paper and it falls to the floor and another girl sees it, which could be disastrous. But instead, what happens is that the other girl, a classmate of hers, says that she's actually seen her and been to the Telegraph Club and that she'll take her sometime if you want. So that's the beginning of this little romance and Lily's coming out story. And Melinda Lowe just does such a great job of establishing this setting of 1950s San Francisco Chinatown. She weaves in these different political elements, things that are happening at the same time. And there's also some higher stakes because obviously being out and queer as a teenager in the 50s would be a pretty big deal. So,
oh my God.
Yeah. And it's made even more difficult because, again, 1950s, there's all of this rhetoric around communism. Her father has just been questioned because he treated a patient who apparently or supposedly is a communist. And because he didn't basically reveal any private information, because he didn't sell this patient out, they take away his immigration papers. So that puts him and their whole family at risk. They're kind of in this really weird limbo where the government is trying to pressure him to say things about this patient so that he can get his papers back, which is awful. So it's a lot of pressure to not step out of line, because basically anything you do that's not in line can make the government think that you're a communist and a threat. So that's kind of the background as Lily begins to explore this side of herself more, as she starts to sneak out to the Telegraph Club more and more, where she is the only Asian person and often the only person of color in the room. So she kind of has this, she has this line where she talks about being split in two, where at home she's only allowed to be the good Chinese girl. That's the only part of her that's allowed through the door at her family's house. But then when she's at the Telegraph Club, she doesn't have anyone else there who's not white. So it's there's not really any place for her to be her entire self. She's kind of picking one or the other where she has community, which is really difficult. Yeah, and there's this love story between Kath and Lily, which really feels like a teenage love story. It's very cute. It's, you know, the kind of overwhelming feelings that you'd have for a teen first love, but then it's complicated because it's at the same time Lily is realizing that she's queer and trying to sort out what that means. And I also liked there are some chapters that are from other people's points of view in different time periods. So you get to see a little bit of her mother's backstory, her father's backstory, and her aunt's backstory, and all the things that happened to lead them to this point, which just made it feel like, it almost felt like a family saga, even though this is really just about Lily, but those chapters made it feel bigger. And it's just so beautifully told, and I absolutely understand why it won all these awards and why everyone mm-hmm. has been talking about it. And yes, it was a 5-star and I should have read it earlier, but it is just as good as everyone says. And that's Last Night at the Telegraph Club by Melinda Lowe.
Believe the hype.
Yeah, exactly.
This reminds me, have you read or heard of The Most Dazzling Girl in Berlin by Kip Wilson?
Oh, I've heard of it. I haven't read it, though.
Have it's you? A novel in verse. Yes.
Oh.
It's a novel in verse. It takes place in 1930s Berlin, like right at the cusp. The P comes after the S. Right at the cusp of World War II. And I'm always fascinated by novels in verse because mm-hmm. of how concise and succinct they are. Like a lot of times they're not. Well, I mean, poetry doesn't have to rhyme, but I'm just saying, like, the language is so succinct and mm-hmm. tells so much in fewer words. So basically, it follows Hilda. She's an orphan, and she basically, like, ages out of the orphanage at 18, and then she's just wandering around. Doesn't know where to go. Mm. You can imagine there aren't many like resources she can tap into. I mean, even today, like foster kids have it rough. Yeah. But so this is the 30s in Berlin, and she stumbles upon this queer club called Cafe Lila, and she meets Rosa, who is like this Rosa thick, honey, like Rosa got like thick with 3 C's type of, you know, like she's like, ooh. And she's a performer, a waitress, so she gets a job there. She's immediately accepted, and people are welcoming and warm there. And but outside of Cafe Lila, there is all this hate that is stewing and mm-hmm. is about to culminate into World War II. So it's an interesting, just like the basics mm-hmm. reminded me of this book. So that's what I was like, oh, this kind of sounds like,
yeah,
well, it takes place 20 years before, but yes, recommend that as well. So the next book I have is Ray Bearer by Jordan Ifueko. I love this fantasy book. I've talked about it before, so I'll try to keep it brief. And also the queerness isn't revealed until a little later, and it's a main character, but I won't say who because it's kind of part of the plot. So basically it follows Tara Sy. We meet her when she is 12, if my memory serves, 12, 11 or 12 or so. And she, like, on the one hand, she has this privileged life because she never has to worry about food or anything. And she has these private tutors and she's learning all this stuff. But at the same time, it's this terribly miserable experience because her mother, who she only knows as the lady, sounds very cold, is absent. She has no friends, and there is like this enchantment on their house where people can't really see them. They're like invisible, basically. So this is all in the name of a mission her mother, aka the lady, wants her to complete, which is to get into the crown prince's close circle, basically called the Council of 11, and then to later kill him. So the Council of 11 is a group of, obviously, 11 kids who the ruler of the empire is called Eretzar. They are people that the ruler bonds with when they are still a kid. And it's a special bond that is felt through this phenomenon called the Ray, hence the name Ray Bearer. The Ray is like deeper than blood. It's this kind of like, you know, magical connection. This is a fantasy, obviously. So she goes to the capital, competes with other kids, and she becomes one of the 11. Thing is, she actually likes the prince and the other kids because, again, they've bonded.
Mm-hmm. But and even if she didn't like them, she's not a murderous person, so she wouldn't want to kill them even if she disliked them. But mm-hmm. her mother has been plotting this for a while, and her mother can literally command her to kill the prince, like, if she wants to, because of what Teresai's father is. I'll let you find out what that is. So the question is, of course, how will this all turn out? I will add, though, too, the mother sounds awful, and she kind of is. She is. But she has allies because of how terrible the current ruler of Eretzar is. So mm-hmm. basically, there is this agreement that the Empire has with the underworld that ended the war years ago, but the price is terrible. So each year, 300 children are sent from a place called Songland, which is like a country, basically, that sits right outside the Empire. 300 children are sent from Songland to the underworld. And Songland is poor because years ago they refused to accept the Empire's sovereignty. So they basically got boxed out of trade, and their children were offered up as sacrifice to keep peace between the underworld and the world of the living. So the sacrifice is interesting, because the kids who are meant to be sacrificed are called redemptors. They are born with these maps on their skin, and the maps are meant to guide them back out of the underworld once they're sent in. But as you might guess, children sent into the underworld, many don't make it back out. And so it used to be that kids from different regions were sent, but for the last 500 years, only kids from Songland have been sent. Hence the animosity for the current ruler, because there's something with that. So, one thing that I absolutely love about this book is how lived in the world feels. It feels like it's mostly inspired by like West African geography and lore. And there's this really cool, piece of the magic system in which, they communicate through drums, which also felt very West African. There's a lot of Nigerian specific influence, but there are other West African cultures as well, I believe. I'm just more familiar with the Nigerian, culture. There are also other regions of Africa, the Middle East, and Asia that I feel the book gets its inspiration from in terms of the food, the clothing, the language. And it just tickles a part of my brain in a good way to see different mythologies played out and come to life. So I really super love this one. I've been meaning to read the second book. I haven't gotten to it yet, but yeah, that's, you know, Ray Bearer by Jordan Ifueko.
There's just so many books.
There's just so many books. I was teasing you earlier, but I totally understand. Like, so many.
So my next book, I realized I picked two that are really about religious trauma. So sorry about that. But this one is.
It's real.
So this one is Into the Light by Marco Shiro. I also really recommend Anger is a Gift by the same author. I love Marco Shiro. They are amazing. But this one, I think I will have trouble describing it because there are some twists, there are some reveals, but I will say one of the points of view is Manny, who is a queer teen on the run. He has been disowned by his family, and he's basically been hitchhiking and trying to figure out how to survive. And he has kind of fallen in with this family, and including a teenage son who he's got a little bit of a crush on. And his personal rules are that he should just keep moving. He doesn't stay in one situation very long. He doesn't want to wear out his welcome. So this family has really been helping him and taking him in. And he is struggling to decide whether he should stick with them a little bit longer and actually trust them, or whether it's not safe for him. Basically, because that's what's happened every other time, is that people have betrayed him, or they've wanted things that are not appropriate, or any number of things that happen to a queer teen runaway hitchhiking. So he is kind of going back and forth about whether he can actually trust these people, or whether he should just take his chances and disappear like he usually does.
So that's one of the points of view. And in that point of view, you know, something happened in Manny's past. Obviously, he was disowned. You know, there's some sort of backstory there. You're not really sure what it is. And then there are, I think it's two more points of view. I'm trying to remember at least one more where we meet Eli, who is living in this secluded community where it is a very religious kind of cult, and it's quite repressive, and he is taking part in basically this pray away the gay type camp, and he is living this very regimented life, but he kind of also feels like there's something that happened to him that he can't quite remember, and things are there's a lot of question marks in his life. And then Manny finds out that someone, a body has been found in the hills of Idlewood, and he is worried that it might be his sister, and he has to kind of face his past and try to track her down, make sure she is safe, make sure that she isn't the body that was found. So yeah, I'm trying to figure out how to talk about this book because it's so good and it's so well told. The storytelling is not completely linear, and it's a bit difficult to get into at first until you figure out what is happening with this book, mm-hmm. and why it's being told that way. And then it makes complete sense and really couldn't be told any other way. Mm. And I'll also say, I don't think it's a spoiler to say this is mostly realistic, but there is a kind of, this was published by Tor Teen. So that was kind of the giveaway that this isn't 100% realistic. There's some right. sort of speculative element at some point, but you're not really sure what it is until near to the end. This is, yeah, the plot is so interesting and the way things twist together and these stories finally come together is really gratifying. It's a heartbreaking story because it's really based on true events, like we were talking about with the horror before. It's also, a lot of it is drawn from the author's own experiences and experiences of other queer kids of color. I definitely recommend checking out the trigger warnings, especially for racism, queer phobia, child abuse, and religious abuse. But it's just so powerful. It's so well done. I went into this with really high expectations because I really love Oshira's writing, and it definitely lived up to it. So if you're looking for a kind of dark thriller sort of YA book, I highly recommend this one. That's Into the Light by Mark Oshira.
I want to say quickly, because I know we've been talking for a minute. So I'm not trying to hold you too long, Danica. But like you said, it's this type of story can very well be something pulled from real life. Mm-hmm. I learned when I was working in a public library in Maryland, we had a kind of like, I was going to say a queer patron task force. Basically, we were focusing on, it was a work group that focused on like making the library more accessible to queer patrons, more welcoming, mm-hmm. et cetera. And I found out that queer teens are more likely to experience homelessness. Mm-hmm. And this becomes compounded by the fact that, like, if they are queer teens of color, the mm-hmm. likelihood is even worse. So that just, I just wanted to say that because that is a very real thing. But yeah, very sad. And we need to be aware of things like that. See, mm-hmm. you know, if we can help when we can. So
My last book today is A Lot's Away by Darcy Little Badger. And this takes place in a world very similar to our own, but like with a little twist, a little spice, a little saison, a little seasoning, you know what I mean? So it's interesting how the magic system works here, because it's like different magic systems. So main character, A Lot's Away, or Ellie, is Lipan Apache. And her culture, their lore is real. She's a ghost whisperer. She can summon the dead, basically the ghosts of dead animals. But also European fairies are real. There are vampires. And so like you have these different mythologies that exist at the same time. Kind of reminds me of American Gods by Neil Gaiman. Mm. How like I just had the impression like if a group of people believe in this deity or this thing strong enough, it's real. Mm-hmm. For it manifests in real life. So I like that element of it. So anyway, one day her cousin appears to her in a dream and he tells her he's been murdered, but when she wakes up, they will say his death was an unfortunate car accident of some sort, or an accident. I forget if it was a car accident. I think it was a car accident. I read this a while ago. An accident. And he's like, please protect my wife and kid. This dude killed me. Da da da, right? So then she and her parents go to this small town called Willoughby. And she is there to help her cousin's family out and mourn with them. And she's also determined to find out exactly how he was murdered and to expose the truth. So the town of Willoughby is such a great setting because it's one of those eerie small towns you see in shows where everyone's like nice, but you get these little hints that like something is weird. I love that juxtaposition where it's like, mm-hmm. Oh my God, everyone's so nice, white picket fence. And then it has these like small little hints like that like it feels like nails on a chalkboard when you see it, kind of like just shakes you, rattles you. Because Willoughby has some horrible secrets that are part of the town's history and that everyone accepts. So also another thing I loved here was the friendship between Ellie and Jay, her road dog. Everybody needs a road dog, right? So Jay is that. Jay is also a descendant of the fairy king Oberon. So that's an interesting friendship. Jay can like travel through these like things called fairy rings, if I recall correctly. So that's cool. He's really supportive. And I like that their relationship stays firmly platonic because Ellie is asexual, actually. So there's also this really cool moment where Ellie's mom that's like fighting back against the colonizers type thing. Y'all gonna see it if you read it. And the aspect of Ellie's abilities are... one aspect of Ellie's abilities that's really cool is like as she progresses in her ability, her skill, it takes her to very interesting places. So I really like it. Again, that is A Lot's Away by Darcy Little Badger.
I want to give just a quick shout out for one more because obviously I had trouble keeping it to four.
That's fine.
But I will just quickly say The Heartbreak Bakery by Air Capetta. It is about an agender teenage baker who has just been broken up with and makes some brownies that turn out to have magical properties that break up all the couples that eat them. So...
Raggedy.
Sid, that was not on purpose. And now okay. Sid is like... I gotta fix this. So Sid teams up with the gender fluid bakery delivery person, tries to track down all the people who bought these brownies and try to get them back together. And also Sid has to process the breakup and maybe there's gonna be a romance with the delivery person. Who knows? But this is the bakery... is all queer, and there are just so many queer side characters, and it's just a great book about queer community. It is so cute. It just feels like a queer hug. I highly, highly recommend it if you just want something really heartwarming. That's The Heartbreak Bakery by Air Capetta.
I love it. Yes, this is quite the collection.
There's a lot here in terms of like content warning and stuff, but there's also like, I love that you ended on a really cute, fluffy note.
Yeah.
I appreciate that. I really do. So yeah, that's all we have for y'all today. Thank you so much for tuning in this week. Please leave feedback about the show on Apple Podcasts to let us know how we're doing and to help others find us. You can also email us at heyya@bookriot.com. Don't forget to visit bookriot.com for newsletters, more podcasts, and all things bookish. And thanks again to today's sponsors for helping make the show possible. And thanks especially to our awesome audio editor, Caitlin Brame. You can follow me on Twitter still. Yeah, I know. At @Erica_EZE_. And Danica, where can people find you?
You can find me at the Lesbury, LESBRARY.com.
Nice. All right. That's our show. We'll see you again with a full episode in 2 weeks. Happy reading.
Happy reading.